Okay, let me start with this. I was asked to give you this particular information about a seminar that we will have together with the Institute at Jessamun. Forschungsingenieurhochschule, FIH. That is taking place on Monday. It's about ethics in cyber conflict. There's a nice program attached to it. And there is a free lunch. That will attract people. The downside of the free lunch is that you're more or less mandatory participating in the group discussion at the end of the day. So after 12, after the lunch. If you're interested, not sure if there is a link in this document where to register. Okay, if you're interested, let me know. Then I can figure out where to send you. Yeah, that's getting complicated. Okay, messed that up. One sec. Let's forget about that then. Close that. Now we go here. Then we go to the topic of today, malicious software first, and then I'll say something about buffer overflow in the second part. And in between, I'll also announce the last assignment. There we are. Okay, that's the overview from the book. I'll start with some types of malicious software. I'll go to advanced persistent threats, and then I'll say something about propagation of malware, what the payload does, and also important, what kind of countermeasures there are. So here is a definition, you can all read that. A program that is inserted into a system, usually covertly, so that we don't know that it happened, with the intent of compromising the confidentiality, integrity, or availability of the victim's data, application, or operating system, or otherwise annoying or disrupting the victim, or more of the above. So that's what it does. There is a... that picture should not be there. Terminology. So there is some terminology. Most of it we'll see from advanced persistent threat, which we'll cover in the next slides, to logic bomb, and then it even goes further with macro virus up to zombies and bots. Zombie we mentioned a couple of presentations before. Also worm virus. All of these names will show up in this presentation. We can classify malware in two broad categories. We can classify them according to the manner in which they propagate, in the manner in which it spreads around. And we can classify them based on what actions they actually take, what the payload of the malware is. There are different classifications possible. I can classify it into something that needs a host or that can work independently. I can classify it as something that doesn't replicate or replicate or whatever, but we'll stick to the first two. Propagation methods that we can see is infection of existing executables and trying to spread in that way to other systems. Using software vulnerabilities, so using a kind of backdoor or a bug in a program, and also social engineering. So people from India calling you as Microsoft operators, or an email that is showing that there is something wrong with a service that you're using, and they're asking you to click or whatever. And the payload, so that's the way that it can propagate. We'll go into all of these. The payload actions could be corruption of the system. It can be data, could be the physical system also. Creation of zombie agents, which are used in DDoS attacks, for example. Theft of information, relevant information, personal information, confidential information, company secrets or whatever. And an action could also be the hiding on of its presence on the system. That's one of the actions probably. If it's just hide, it's just playing hide and seek. It's not doing a lot, of course. So there's more than just hiding. The original viruses and worms and everything, the original malware written many years ago, many decades ago, those were done by smart people who knew a lot about software and how they could misuse it. Nowadays, you don't have to be that smart anymore. You have to have money, and then you can just buy the software. There are kits, toolkits that can create the actual virus or the actual malware that you are interested in. Often referred to as crimeware. Zeus was, from my point of view, a Greek god. Black hole was something in the sky, but apparently they have also other meanings. So there are a number of toolkits available that you can just buy and you can use, and you can create your own malware. Let's go to advanced persistent threat first. There are three words in there. Let's say a bit about each of them. So advanced means that actually a wide variety of tools is used, a wide variety of technologies is included in the malware. So it has it's advanced in the sense that it can do a lot of things. These components that we find in the advanced persistent threat are often targeted to a specific target. So that it's not just something that we spread and we see who will. In fact, no, this is targeted at a specific person or a specific organization. Then persistent. The people using these kinds of threats, they are not interested in a quick win. They really want to attack a specific target, and they will be patient enough to wait some time for that and to plan everything very carefully. And threats is that for example, that people are involved. This is not just an automatic process. People will follow what the threat is doing, what the APT is doing, and then they can manipulate using that. So this is not something that you and I could do. This is normally larger organizations, criminal organizations, governmental organizations that are involved in these kinds of things. The aims can be different. Could be anything from stealing information, one company attacking another, one government attacking another, trying to steal confidential or secret information, maybe disrupting infrastructures or whatever. Many techniques used, so they don't just stick to one, but they try a broad spectrum of techniques to make sure that they reach the goal that they intend. So they can use social engineering, spear phishing emails, which we'll discuss in a minute, drive-by downloads. So they use whatever they can, whatever is needed to reach the particular target. And then the intent is to infect the target with this particular sophisticated malware. Let's look at some more common malware types. Let's start with viruses. So a virus is, we all know that, a virus is simply a piece of software that that infects another program. So it attaches itself to an executable program, and then once that program is run, the virus will be active. So it modifies the software in some way. And it attaches it to the start of the software such that it, once the software runs, the virus will first be active, do its work, and then hand over control to the normal software. And so it starts first, and it tries to replicate, it tries to spread, And if needed, it will also start to do its work, the malicious work. When it is attached to a particular program, it will have the same rights, of course, as that program. And so if I run something here on my computer with administrator rights, the virus attached to that will have the same rights. If I run it with user rights, the virus will also have user rights. And so it will attach to something that would obviously with high rights, as high as possible. Those are the let's say the normal viruses. Macroviruses are common now also, but not in the beginning. But they use the fact that there is active content in also Word documents or PDF documents. So user documents, not programs, not executables, but documents that we use. And they use the fact that we need active content there also, and then they use that. I will say a bit about that also. When we look at the computer virus, there are actually three parts in that. First, there is an infection mechanism. It wants to spread. Then there is a trigger, and then there is the payload. The infection mechanism actually describes how the virus will spread. The trigger is some kind of an event that will make the virus start its real work. So spreading is nice, but spreading is nice because many computers are infected, and then on many computers I can do my malicious actions. If a virus would start immediately by doing these malicious actions, it will be detected very early before it can spread wide. And so then it's not as effective. So if it first has some time to spread before it starts being active, then obviously the impact will be much bigger. And so it waits a while until there is some kind of trigger that says, okay, and now start doing your malicious action. Can be anything, can be a number of times it's copied, can be a particular date, can be whatever you want. Can be that multiple programs are running actively, and then that could be a trigger too. The payload is what the virus does, so the malicious actions. Can be anything from damaging to just being annoying, just displaying something or whatever. If we look at the virus lifetime, then there could be a dormant phase where it's just sitting around doing nothing, not present in all viruses. The propagation phase is making sure that it spreads around, spreads to other computers, other documents, or whatever. Copy might not be identical. Why? If the copy of a virus is the same every time, it's very easy to detect. I can make a signature of that, and I can look at that signature, and then I can find it. Yeah. So if it makes small changes, it will be harder to detect. Then the trigger phase. Trigger phase is indeed, as I said, just to make sure that now something happens that will make me sure, that will make that the virus is starting to be malicious, doing its real payload actions. It could wait a month before it starts acting or whatever. Different triggers possible. And then the execution, as I mentioned. So here we have a virus. Probably not a very good virus. You see, in the beginning, there is some kind of identifier, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That is just showing that, hey, this is a file that has been infected by a virus, and this is the identifier of this virus. And then what at the bottom of the page, what the virus will do is it will attach it to other programs. And then if the trigger condition holds, then it can also do the actual action. And that repeats. This virus will be attached to the start of a program, and so when I run that program, the virus will run first, it will spread, it will see if it should trigger, and if not, it will hand over to the actual application. But if there's a virus attached to my application, what will happen is I will have an application that all of a sudden is a bit bigger. Okay, that's again something that I could detect. So that's maybe not the smartest way. So another virus, slightly smarter, is a compression virus. And the compression virus actually takes the original file, it shrinks it a little bit such that if it attaches itself to the beginning, at least the size is the same. So it doesn't really show right away. And then when that file is run, the virus runs first, tries to spread, sees if the trigger is the trigger condition holds, so it can start the payload. If not, it will look at the compressed original program, will decompress it, and then we'll run that. So here is how it works. We have a file that is infected by the virus already, and then it tries to spread first, so it sees another file, P2, and wants to infect that file too. And so it first shrinks it before the virus is also attached to that second file. So now it has spread to the other file, and then it has to, of course, decompress its original program and run that. Yeah, so it's not noticeable for the user that actually something is wrong. If it would not allow the program to run, then the user would know that there's something wrong, and it would start checking. We can classify viruses by either by target or by consumer, probably also in different ways. By target, so there are different parts of a computer system that a virus can attack. It can attack the boot sector. It can attack the files. It could be a macro virus, so attacking document files, or it could be a combination of those. And the way that a virus hides itself could either be by encrypting part of the payload inside the virus is encrypted, so that if you see the code that you don't know what it's doing. It could be a stealth virus which actually encrypts all of it, not just the payload. It could be polymorphic. So I said if a virus makes an exact copy of itself, yeah, that's easy to detect. So polymorphic means that the copy that a virus makes is slightly different every time. Can also be done with encrypted viruses. Every time that it is copied, the payload is encrypted with a different key, yeah, which makes the file different, except for some parts. Could be a metamorphic virus even. Doesn't just make small changes in the code itself. It could also change its behavior. Macrovirus, as said, there are advantages and disadvantages to that. They run on multiple platforms. Generally, when I design a virus, I have to determine what operating system I will attack. Different operating systems have different properties, and so I have to determine which operating system has particular weaknesses that I want to evaluate. If I have a macrovirus, if it's a Word document, for example, then Word runs on many systems. Doesn't just run on Windows; it runs on other systems too. Yeah, so for the attacker, that has a specific advantage, of course, because he's not restricted to attacking a single operating system. Also, these kinds of documents, these kinds of files, are used for sharing a lot. Obviously, I have a set of files on my system, a set of documents on my system that I will use for my own. But I share documents with you. I upload them to Blackboard, and you download them. If one of them would contain a virus, you would all have that. Yeah. If it's a regular virus, I don't upload executables, or it's not as common as file documents. Okay, so that was a bit about viruses. Then we go to worms. There is a large overlap between all these kinds of types of malware, I should say. The difference between a virus and a worm is that the virus attaches itself to a file, an executable, and once that particular program is run, the virus becomes active. A worm is able to work on its own, so it doesn't need a, let's say, a host. For the rest, there is a lot in common. It will also again try to spread, to propagate first. Similar ways as a virus, I guess. So it tries to find new systems to infect. Can be over a local network, can be using flash drives, can be using emails or whatever. The first worm was actually not a use as malware. The first worm was at Palo Alto Labs from Xerox, and that was written to find idle computing time, so that particular researchers could use the time that computers were idle for their calculation. And they used similar techniques as now in the malware for worms, except they had good thoughts with that. So a bit about replication. There are many ways. Electronic mail, instant messages. I'm not sure if you get those, but a couple of times, at least from three different people, I got on Skype this link from Badoo. Has anybody else got that? Some. Okay. Don't click that, by the way. Ever click that? I got it from one student in this course, and he was sorry. He thought he would then fail the course. No. If there are students that get the link and they click on it, they fail the course. Email is much more common, of course, to use. File sharing, either uploading it to a website and other people downloading it, or using flash drives or whatever. So there are different ways that a worm will be able to replicate itself. If a worm tries to replicate it, it's looking at the potential new host. It's looking for potential new host to infect. And so how can they do that? There are actually four ways of doing that. First is just random. I'll just try somebody and I'll see if I can infect that particular person, that particular system. Yeah, randomly. Which means that there is not always 100% success. So I need to try and propagate to as many random systems as possible and then hope for the best. But that generally will generate a lot of network traffic, or traffic in general, and that might be easier to detect again. Yeah, so although it could spread easily, there are detection problems for the worm in this particular case. Then I could have a particular list of targets in mind when I create the worm. And so I'll make a list, a hit list. I make a list of systems that I want to infect, and I'll attach that to the worm, and then the worm just gets a part of that list and tries to infect that particular system. It could inspect my system, see where my connections are, and use that information to spread, or, which is also part of that, it could look at my local network and then try to spread over my local network. Yeah, it's a limited area where it will then spread, but it has at the very least the advantage that there is one control at the border of my local area network, the firewall. At least it will not be bothered by a firewall when it is only on the local area network. Yeah, so they use different techniques to spread. So how fast do they spread? There is some from biology. There is actually some formula. That is the derivative of the function I. I is the number of infected systems as a function of time. And that derivative of I is equal to some constant beta times the number of infected systems times the number of susceptible systems. Every time a system gets infected, obviously it moves from that list of susceptible to the list of infected, so that the total sum of the two is constant. And if you look at how then the propagation will be, so that's the line going up, more and more systems will be infected, assuming that there is no protection. In the beginning, it will go very fast. It will go exponentially. If I have one system that is infected, and I will look for another system, yeah, at the next time it will have found one, I'll have two infected systems. Then both of them will look for a new system to infect, and so then they will infect two new systems, and I will have four, and I will have 8, 16. Yeah, so in the beginning it will go exponentially. Then at some point in time, there are two systems that are infected and they're trying to infect the same susceptible system. Yeah, so it's not going exponentially, it will slow down to linear. And then at the very end it will even go slower because many, many systems are infected already. And so yeah, it should slow down to towards the end until all systems are infected. Yeah, but obviously the goal is in the beginning to infect as many systems as possible in a short period of time. The Morris worm was actually one of the first one known. It's actually not the first one, except the one at Palo Alto. There was a German student who wrote actually the year before, who wanted to send Christmas cards to his friends, and so he wrote some software to send it out to all of his friends in the email list, except that somehow when people got that, they were sending out to all of the people in their email list, etc., and that spread very fast. So it was more or less an accidental worm. But this was the first one apparently intended, or one of the first ones intended, as doing something malicious. Yeah. It used the Unix system to spread. Used different techniques to crack passwords, and then some weaknesses in the Unix system. Exploited the trapdoor. I will talk about trapdoors in a minute also. And use something to receive and send email unnoticed. Some worm technologies, I will do this also very quickly. It could be multi-platform, so not just attacking a Unix system or a Windows system or whatever, but look at different platforms. It can use a number of different exploits. Bugs in browser or email or file sharing. It tries to spread as fast as possible. Again, spreading first very fast and to infect as many systems as possible is a good thing, because once the payload gets active, there will be people trying to stop it. And if you just have a small base, then obviously then the attack is not as effective. Can be polymorphic and metamorphic, as same as for viruses. Can spread in various ways. And zero-day exploits. A worm needs to exploit some bug, some weakness in the system. And if I build a worm based on a known bug, where there is a patch for that particular weakness already, that's possible, because not everybody installs their patches right away. But obviously, it's not as effective. So if I have a zero-day exploit, a bug that has not been detected yet or has not been patched yet, then obviously I can do much more harm. Again, people are buying these worms or creating them based on software. The price for a zero-day vulnerability obviously will be higher. Okay. I think one more slide also on the social engineering. In social engineering, the attacker is trying to gain some information from a user, either by spam or email, but he's trying to attack a system based on the help of the own user. Spam, we get a lot of email that we know is spam. At least all of us know that it is spam. My grandmother might have a bit of difficulty with that, but anyway. We have these emails that we have, that there is some rich guy died and there is the inheritance that nobody claimed. And okay, you're a nice guy, so we can share, right? And if you only give me your banking details and your credit card number and everything, then I will make sure that you get the money. Those are getting less and less nowadays. The last few that I saw was all that my mailbox was getting full or was getting out of expiry, and then I needed to do some action to make sure that I could keep my email. Anyway, all of those try to gain some information from the actual user. Maybe lure them to a website where they fill in personal information that could be misused, or maybe to a website where there will be malicious software that will be downloaded to the system or whatever. Trojan Horse is a program that contains malicious software. You all know the story about the Trojan Horse, the background. Okay, so I don't need to go in there. Different models apparently that can be followed. The idea there is to infect a system and to extract as much information later on as possible, not to do harm right away or something, or not to spread to many systems, but to really attack a single system. Okay, so we had something about the propagation of malware. Let's look at what actually the malware can do. So again, a number of different options. The first one could be destruction of data. There are different viruses here mentioned. Chernobyl virus that overwrote some of the some part of the hard drive, which made everything less accessible. There was a Kless worm that actually, as one of the steps, deleted the antivirus program, so it was less detectable, and apparently the files were emptied in some way. And so again, the data was not available anymore. Ransomware, getting a bigger and bigger problem also now. You download a worm or a virus, and it will encrypt your files, and only if you pay some kind of ransom money, you will get the key to decrypt it. Early days, they had apparently weak crypto that could be decrypted anyway. Nowadays, they are getting better and better. Yeah, that's data destruction. So the information on my computer is destructed. Yeah, if I have a good backup, I can just format the hard drive and just install everything again. Physical destruction is also possible. Apparently, the Chernobyl virus also tried to rewrite the BIOS code, which meant that if you restarted your system, you did not have access anymore. Obviously, much more severe. Stuxnet. Who knows Stuxnet? Who doesn't know Stuxnet? Easier question. Everybody knows that. Stuxnet was actually targeted against the Iranian nuclear program, trying to destroy physically some of the centrifuges, and then have that as a stop or a delay in their program. They try to, if they look at the centrifuges, what they try to do is first speed them up, then get back to normal speed again, and then a few days later slow them down, and that should give some vibration in the centrifuges that would destroy them. Logic bomb. This has to do with the triggers. So logic bomb is just having a trigger in the malware, and once that trigger becomes valid, then the bomb explodes and the malware starts doing their work. Triggers could be a date, as I said, the presence or an absence of a file, an active program, or maybe a combination of active programs, or whatever you want. The Christmas worm was one of that, one of the examples there. There is a famous case, an employee working at Omega, a company, who worked his way up from a normal worker into system administration, whatever, and he got a leading position, but then he started being sloppy in his work and he got demoted, and at some point he was even fired. And actually 3 weeks after he was fired, a logical bomb, a virus, destroyed all of their servers, the data on their servers. And when they tried to set back the backup, apparently the backup tape had disappeared also. So he was convicted to a number of years in prison, number of months at least, I don't know, and a very high fine also. Doesn't always pay to do these kinds of things. The payload could also be a bot or a zombie. Yeah, so the attacker gets control over your system and can use it for his own advantages. Not so much destroying your data, destroying your computer, but using your storage, using your computing power, using your network, your broadband connection, etc. Number of different ways that they can use it. They can use it in a DDoS attack. Yeah, so making sure that the attack comes from more sources. Manipulating online polls or games. Yeah, so if you have a botnet in the United States and you want to influence the election polls, you can use it. If you want to have your favorite person win at idols, you could use many of these bots to vote for you. Connected to a bot is also a remote control facility, command and control facility. And yeah, that's also the main difference between a bot and a worm. Both of them work independently. They don't need, like a virus, they don't need a host to attach to. They can work as independent programs. But the worm works on itself in the sense that it will propagate itself and it will activate itself, while the bot is there to under the control of a central facility. Apparently, often an IRC server is used for control and command. And so when there is a chat on a specific channel, the bot go there, and then all the information there is interpreted as commands for the bot. That has a disadvantage. That has a disadvantage if that IRC channel is taken down, and then the bot is no longer under control of the attacker. So there are different ways. There are peer-to-peer protocols also. So if one of these systems is taken down, others are used to connect to the bot. Or sometimes the attackers use a large number of control and command servers, again, because that is the heart of the system. So the authorities are trying to take those down, but once they take one down, the bot has a list of potential servers. It will just hop to the next one. Something about information theft, keyloggers, etc. I must admit, I don't have this detailed knowledge, but in principle, when we talk about a number of control and command servers, It doesn't matter if they have a list of those or if they can generate themselves using what DNS flexing. Yeah. As long as once they try to connect the command and control server and it doesn't respond, they can just go over to a new one. If it's from a list or if it's generated on the fly, that doesn't really matter. Yeah. But there, the point is that there should be a backup because the command and control server could be a single point of failure. Once that single point of failure is indeed failing, yeah, then they have this backup mechanism. Keyloggers, keylogger is what it does. It logs whatever you type on the keyboard. In terms of biometrics, it's very interesting. But these attackers, what they're trying to do is steal information from you. And the most relevant information they're interested in is passwords, of course. Maybe credit card information or something like that. Yeah, so personal information. If you talk about industrial espionage, it could also be other kind of information. If they would just collect everything, that would be a lot of information. So what they generally do is look for trigger words. Yeah, they see login, they see password or whatever, and then they start really collecting the data. If they would collect everything, it would also be noticeable when all that information is transmitted back to the attacker. Yeah, so that's why they want to keep it to a minimal. Spyware is a similar thing, except that it monitors more than just the keyboard. Yeah. Phishing. We talked about phishing also. So the emails that are trying to lure you into going to a particular site to provide some information. Could also be the Indian Microsoft operator calling you and telling you that you have a big problem. I had that once. I thought it was interesting, and I just kept the guy talking for a while. And he said, yeah, okay, you have a problem on your computer. Now go to this and this website. I said, no, I don't want to do that. Why not? I said, it could be infected. So I asked him, if I would send you an email with a link, would you click on that? No, he wouldn't click on that. But this is the same. No, it was different. So, yeah, they are not very very smart. But it is fun. If it ever happens to you, just keep them talking for a while. It's fun. So, you probably all know what phishing is. So, they are trying to get some information for you. They send out these general emails to everybody. There is also spear phishing, which is pointed at a particular victim. So they have some information from you, and they are trying to, if I get a general email, dear sir, then yeah, that's easy to recognize. But if they know information about me, and they address me by my name, and they give me personal information, all of a sudden it becomes more tangible, yeah, more realistic, and it's easier to, or more likely that somebody would click on that, yeah? Obviously more work for the attacker. They have to investigate time on that, but the response could be higher because most people by now know that there are not that many rich people that die and leave their money to nobody. Backdoor, I mentioned that also, also called trapdoor. A backdoor is often a valid part of the software. It's used during development, that the developer doesn't always need to go through this authentication process. Maybe if something is wrong with the software when it is deployed, yeah, they have to have access to it without going through the normal channels. So often there are backdoors or trapdoors inside software. But yeah, that will also give a handle to an attacker to misuse that. In terms of protection, it's difficult to protect against that because it is regular software and the backdoor is a functionality of the software. It's kept secret, of course. If you're going to promote it, obviously many attackers will use it. But yeah, so it's difficult to protect against that. Rootkits. Set of programs installed on a system to maintain covert access with root privileges or with high privileges. And trying to hide, of course, its presence. There are different types again. They run in different modes. For example, it used to run in user mode before, but then they went deeper into the system to get more privileges. So at some point they were looking at rootkits, kernel mode rootkits. Sorry. That actually coexists then with the normal operating system. And if I can use it to alter function calls, then I can misuse it in this way. For example, there are a number of ways to do this. This is what the normal system does. If you call a particular function, it will look at this the system call table, and then it will be directed to where the code for the system call is found. So what can be done? We can modify the table. Yeah. So the if I want to use sysfork, yeah, it doesn't really point to the real implementation anymore, but it points to some altered implementation. So that's one way that can be done. Or I could just look at that implementation, and I could change the implementation directly. The table would be the same. The table would still point to the same place where that function is, except the function now has a different functionality than what it used to have. Or I could just redirect and just go around the full table. I'm running out of time again, as usual. Let's see quickly. Countermeasures. Well, obviously the countermeasure against malware is prevention. That's the best you can do. If this system doesn't get infected, I don't need to clean it or whatever. I'm not to have to don't have to be afraid of the data. So policy and awareness of the users is very important. Vulnerability and threat mitigation, obviously also. For example, patching software, keeping the latest version of the software on my computer all of the time, very important. But it happens. Even if I try the best, my system at some point might be infected. Once it gets infected, I have to take a number of steps. First of all, of course, I have to detect that I'm infected. Yeah, if there is malware on this system and I don't know about it, I will not do anything. So I have to be able to know that there is malware. Then once I know that there is something wrong with it, I have to see what is wrong with it. There's no general defense. I have to defend against each and every particular malware separately. So I have to identify what malware has infected my system. And once I've done that, I can also remove it. If I look at effective malware requirements for malware countermeasures, there is a number of requirements that has to be fulfilled. Transparency or timeliness, I don't have to wait, it should be relatively fast, etc. Where can I do this? Where can I do the malware countermeasures? I can do them on my system. Yeah, I have virus scanner running. I have different software running here. Yeah, so if I go to a web page or if I download software, there is antivirus software that is checking what is going on. I can do it at the entry of the network, so firewalls, etc. Or I could have a combination of it. That was again quick at the end. No, sorry. I tried to reduce the number of slides, but it's somehow it's still high. Questions about malware, malicious software. Okay, good. That's nice. Let's start in 15 minutes again, and then I'll first say something about the last assignment, and then I will go to buffer overflows. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Let's continue. Oh no, we are not complete yet. I have to wait. I said 15 minutes, so I have to wait a bit. I think we're complete now. Let's then indeed go to the last assignment. Actually, I give a little choice in this last assignment. I know that that some like the programming. I would like to see more of that. I know that some hated the programming and don't want to see more of that. So we had two programming assignments, and the last one was a bit more theoretical, where you had to search information. So I have some theoretical assignments here also. Where's my mouse? There's my mouse. The first group of assignments will be to take one of these given topics and then find information, more or less what you have done for Heartbleed also, but then more related to system security, of course. The topics, there are four topics. The first one is Stuxnet. We mentioned that as an advanced persistent threat already, and what had I done. So find more about Stuxnet, see how it works, why it works, how it was deployed, these kinds of things. Then the onion router, Tor. That could be a nice topic too, so anonymity. So find out how it works. Is it secure? Does it provide what it should provide? How does it provide anonymity, etc., etc.? So write something about Tor. We talked about worms. So a known worm is the conflicker worm. Again, same topic. Or that is the last one. Topic four is a bit away from the other ones. It's about secure programming. One of the ways, at least, that I learned when I was in school, when I was in university, was so-called invariant-based programming. So trying to prove mathematically that a piece of software is correct. Yeah, find something about that. In all cases, it still should be a technical report. 3 to 4 pages, and 3 to 4 pages, use the same template as before, so either the Word or the LaTeX, whatever you prefer. Write 3 to 4 pages, give it a correct name, such that I can identify it, and then submit it. So those are the, let's say, the more theoretical assignments. The more practical assignment is related to a keystroke timing attack. So an article I read some time ago was that when I type on a computer, when I'm locally on the computer, I can measure timing information. I can measure when a key is pressed and when it's released, and I can use that information either for biometrics to authenticate a person, or I could actually also use it to find the text back that somebody is typing. When the information is sent to a server, then I have some timing information. Not as detailed as when I do that locally on the computer, but I have some information. There is a link to a paper there that you can have a look at. Let me see if I have it open that I can show what I wanted to show. Yeah. Show this. So here we somebody types a password, and then I have at least information when all the specific keystrokes are sent. Yeah, so I have some timing information also. Yeah, using SSH in, I forgot the name, in individual mode. Interactive mode, sorry. Yeah. So then the assignment, the more practical assignment is, write a program that captures this information. Yeah, and you doesn't need to be in MATLAB in this case. You can use third-party software. You can use Wireshark and do the measurements for you. But then use your own software to analyze the Wireshark measurements. Yeah. do a small experiment. See if you can detect some difference between typing some letter combinations. Yeah, can you derive something? I'm not asking for a full-fledged experiment where you can, based on the timing information, exactly find back what somebody was typing. That's a bit too far. Yeah, but some small experiment. Because there is programming involved, obviously the report can be shorter. 2 to 3 pages, as I said. If you want 4 pages, you can use the 4 pages also. Yeah, but because there is other work involved, the programming work is in there also, the analysis, the experiment, yeah, it could be a bit shorter. Let's say 2 to 4 pages. I should have said 2 to 4 pages. Yeah? So either pick one of the more theoretical topics, one of the 4 topics there, or this more practical topic. For all, in all cases, the assignment will be available in Blackboard right after this lecture, and then 3 weeks delivery deadline again. Yeah? Is that clear? Any questions? Any preference? I'll not ask what the preference is, and just know that there is preference. Okay, good. Let us go to the next presentation. So chapter 10 in this case on buffer overflow. Just a few sections in this particular chapter. First, explaining something what stack overflow, buffer overflow is. Then we have to defend against it, of course. And if time, then I will say something about how about other overflow attacks also. Anyway, the slides are uploaded to Blackboard. Even if I don't manage to come completely to the end, you will have the information anyway. Okay. First, a definition, buffer overrun, a condition at an interface under which more input can be placed into a buffer or data holding area than the capacity allocated, and then overwriting other information. So I have space reserved for information, but then the information that I put in there is more. Yeah. Attacks exploit such a condition to crash a system, which is relatively easy then, or to insert specially crafted code that allows them to gain control of the system, which is the same techniques, but more difficult on what to put into the what kind of information to put in the buffer. When we look at how a computer stores information, we'll look at that in more detail in a second, then you see that there is room allocated for different variables, for different pointers, etc., etc. If I use more room than is allocated for a particular variable, then it will just mess up other variables also that are close by, or other kind of data. As a potential consequence of that happening, can be also unintentionally that this happens, but as a potential consequence, the data could be corrupted, the program could cache, and in worst cases, the attacker could, in fact, execute some code that he wants, that we don't want to be executed. They could find out information that is stored on the computer, etc., etc. So here we have an example. Who can identify the error in this code? It's simply, I'll tell what the code does. The code next tag is a function that will return a tag value to the string str1. And then the user is asked to input another string, str2. And then valid will be a comparison. Valid will be true if those two strings are the same, and valid will be false if they are not the same, and that information will actually be printed to the screen. That's all that this function does. So where is the error in this code? Yeah? That's okay. But the error is in the get s. Okay, exactly, correct. So let's see what happens if we run this code. Here is how the information is in the memory. So there is room here to store actually str2, and then there's room to store str1, and then there is room to store the integer valid. So there's the code again, just a copy, and assume that this next tag will be correct, and it will assign the value start to str1. If the user would input start when asked for it, 2, 4, 5 characters, that will be okay. There will be no problem. What if the user would input evil input value? Obviously, this is too long. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 letters instead of the 8 that is assigned room for. So what happens then? Well, obviously, str2 will have that value that's inputted. But when it's put in memory, it will overflow into the memory allocated to str1, and actually that last part of str2 will then be put into str1, and so str1 will get the value t value. Yeah, so the first 8 characters are removed. Yeah, but everything more than 8 characters was put in the memory location for str1, so that will be t value. And obviously these two are different. And so the value of valid will be false. So then we have the user input bad input twice. Again, more than 8 characters. So what happens is we see the program will start writing bad input from the memory allocated to str2. Yeah, but then the second bad input will actually flow over into str1. So what happens now? I need to use. Okay. What happens now? Str2 will have that particular value. That's the one that the user assigned. Str1 will have the value bad input, right? Because it flowed over into that memory. What will be the value of valid? But str1 and str2 are not the same. So why can it be true? It is true, by the way. Why? Yeah, but if I would... Normally, if I would compare str1 and str2, it would say that those are not the same. Yeah? But in the compare, strn compare, it just compares the first 8 characters, and those are the same. Yeah, the first 8 characters of str2 are also bad input. So that's why it just looks at the first 8 characters. If it would look at 2 strings, then it would say it's not correct. Yeah. So even though str1 and str2 are different, we could still have a valid that is true. Okay, so there was no check. Actually, the F got the get s. What is it called? The get s function. What is it? Oh, that's the wrong presentation. The get s function in C doesn't check for the length, and so that's why there is something that can go something wrong. In order for an attacker to exploit this, he has to obviously find this bug. He has to identify where a function is called, or where the buffer might suffer from a buffer overflow. Besides that, he needs to have knowledge of where the buffer actually is stored in memory. Yeah. So he can inspect the code. He can find that there is the use of the getAs function or other vulnerable functions. He can trace the execution and see where things can go wrong. He can use particular tools also for that. But yeah, he has to do some investigation to find out what can be done. And I'll talk about Stack Overflow in this case, because we're talking about information on the stack. Can be a buffer in a different part of the memory also, but I will just discuss stack here. Let me see where we are. Yeah. So a Stack Overflow is a buffer overflow in the stack of a computer. Unfortunately, these insecure function calls are still used a lot, and it's hard to avoid them completely. So that leaves a large potential for misusing them. Let me go to. Let me go to explaining how the function call actually works, because that's the basis of the buffer overflow. When one function is calling another function, the program will first execute that called function, but there needs to be some kind of control that once that called function is finished, that control should be given back to the calling function. Some information about where to return in the original program needs to be stored. There needs to be stored information on maybe some parameters that are given to the function. There should be some room on the stack for local variables, etc., etc. So generally here we have a function p calling a function q. Then part of the stack will be reserved for this function q. The function q should know where to return once it's finished, so it should point back to where it came from. There needs to be an old frame pointer. Why? Once the function q is finished, that information needs to be cleared from the stack, and then the old frame stack needs to be reinstalled for continue with execution of function p, and then there can be some local variables and everything. And that's actually these local variables is where we are going to try and to use the buffer overflow. If I write something in the variable local 2, the information will move up when it's written, and it could go over into local 1 as we have seen, but maybe even more than that. Okay, here we have a function again, a hello function. I guess it's clear where this function can go wrong again. It reads it. It doesn't read a tag. It gets a tag as an input into the function, a parameter into the function. It uses the getAs function again, which we know is vulnerable, and then it prints the information. So if we do it right and we run it, the tag that we assign is apparently name, and it says enter a value for name, and we say Bill and Laurie, and then hello. Your name is Bill and Laurie, which are actually the writers of the book, by the way. And then it finishes, right? So the input there was 15 characters, if I counted correctly last time. Yeah, plus a zero character to indicate the end of the string, which is 60, which fits nicely within the buffer. If I would enter something which is way longer than the buffer, then something will go wrong. It will write over the other variables. It will write over the old frame pointer. It will write over the return address, etc., etc. And so things will go wrong, and so the program holds with an error. Okay, let's see if we can do this. The function, what was it called, hello or buffer2 is called. And actually, I want to give such an input that the function calls itself again, which is obviously not what we want. Just fun in this case. Yeah. Again, we need to do some investigation on where the function is loaded, etc., etc. And those values are often static. So if I run it on my own system and I know that it's similar to the text system, I can figure out where it's loaded, etc., etc. So I found out on this system where the hello function was located at some particular address. And I did some more investigation. Actually, we had the return pointer, and then we had the old frame stack, and then we had 24 bytes below that. So that's where the imp variable was stored. Yeah. So once I have more than 24 bytes, I'm starting to write over the other information also. Before I can alter the return address, when starting to write into the buffer, I first have to write over the frame pointer, obviously. Yeah, I'm starting to write, and then bottom up, I first encounter the frame pointer before I encounter the return address. So I have to override that one before I can override the return address. I choose a value that could be okay. Yeah, it's fairly arbitrary what you put there. It should not be too exotic, but I'll choose something that makes sense. And then I input this, actually. And it's done in such a way that the string is interpreted as hex code. So 41 stands for capital A, 42 stands for capital B, etc., etc. And then here, so this actually represents text in the beginning, 24 bytes up to here, I think. And then here, 4 bytes represent the frame pointer, and then we have 4 bytes that represent the return pointer. And you see that the function is started, and it's using that particular input. And you get some bogus reply, of course, because it really can't handle that. But then, let me see if that's here on this slide. Yeah. So what happens then? What happens? We have put the information here. We have adjusted the frame pointer, and we have adjusted the return address. Yeah, and the function then will print the output. Hello, generally, hello, your name is, and then something. Yeah, but that was changed. But then it will look at the return address, and it will continue working from that particular return address again. So we'll jump to that address in memory, and it will continue executing. Well, that particular address actually pointed to this function, and so it will call the function again. And then everything breaks down. The NNN at the end is actually from this. It's encoded here also. Yeah. And then the program fails, of course. So it was nice, but just as a toy example. Yeah, so I could give input in a particular way. I could give input to the program that made the program run again. Very simple. So in this toy example, I just run the same function again. It's nice, but not really. I could have pointed to any other function also. So why execute the hello function again? I could have executed another function. I could have pointed to any code, not necessarily a function, but to any executable code on the machine, and just have it starting executing from where I pointed. If I know that it will start at a point where the instructions make sense, that can work. If I just give it a random point, yeah, then the instructions most likely don't make sense. Yeah, so if I point it, if I have the return pointer pointing to something that makes sense in terms of execution of these commands, I can have those commands executed. And that's actually what they do in these kinds of attacks. What they do is they put those machine instructions actually in the buffer. I was just writing into the buffer text, ABCD in the previous case. Yeah, but now I write machine code in there. And then I point to that position. Yeah, and when the function returns and it's jumping back to where the return pointer is pointing, it will continue executing. Well, that is actually code that I just wrote and put into the buffer. So it will start executing the code. So that's what we're now trying to do. Another unsafe C function. So what is not good in this particular function? So what do we see? We have a function main at the bottom. It reserves a buffer, and then it calls get input, which is on the top. And actually there, fgets is the correct version because it does the checking of the length. Doesn't make sure that there is a buffer overflow there. So that's solved. So what's wrong with this particular function? There's here another buffer, temp. I'll put something in that buffer. We put there in code, text, read val for value, semicolon, and then the value. And the value is actually a string. That's the same string that is put in here. So that could have length 16 already. Yeah, 16 plus what is here. That could add up to more than what is allocated for that particular buffer. Yeah, so there we can have an error too. If I have a small, really small input, safe, and it will give me the good return. If I have something long, it will go wrong. It still writes here. It still writes buffer 3 done, which is the last line here. So actually this function did work. But once it returns from this main back to the calling routine, yeah, then most likely the return address was overwritten by something bogus, and that will fail. Yeah. There's some more functions in C that are not safe or that should be used with care. Let me put it like that. Yeah, you see that. There are safer versions for get as also. Okay, so in the shellcode, what we do is the attacker will create some code, put that in the buffer, and then try to run that. For him or her to do that, he has to have some knowledge. Yeah, it's not like that everybody can do that. One of the things that he needs to be able to do is know how machine code works. Know how to avoid a number of issues. One of the issues is, for example, a zero value will end the string. So if I make my code, I must make sure that there is no zero value in there. Yeah, otherwise it will not work. There's a number of tools available to do this for an attacker, but yeah, he needs some knowledge also. Here we have a shell code. On the top, there is the code that the attacker wants to run, and he wants to encode that and have that as input to the buffer. So that particular code will be put over into machine code, which is here. There's some. If you look at this, who speaks machine code? Some. Okay. You see that here at the top. First of all, it starts with a number of knob, no operation. A knob does nothing. Yeah, so I can have a bunch of knobs, which is called a knob sled, a number of knobs behind each other. Nothing is done. Every time that it sees that instruction knob, okay, go to the next one. Yeah, until it comes to this jump function. And jump will just, it's a go-to. I'm not sure if you ever have heard about go-to. You probably programmed in BASIC also. Yeah. So then you know the go-to, which is called jump here in machine code. It will just go to this particular label. Yeah, and then it will call actually this function. There is a reason behind that. I will not go into details here. That's in the book. Yeah, but that is to make sure that all of these things can work. Here, for example, we have an XOR of twice the same variable. What's the result of an XOR of something with itself? Yeah, it's zero. Yeah. So if a bit is one, then the other bit is also one, and it will XOR to zero. If one bit is zero, then the bit in the second variable is also zero, and it will XOR to zero again. Yeah. Why don't they just assign zero to something? Because there could not be zero in the code. Yeah, because that would terminate the string. And so there are some tricks in this code. So the based on the shell code at the top, the machine code is written, and then that is transferred into bytes that do this particular activity. So the step from the machine code to the hexadecimal values, that's a one-on-one translation. I don't know anything about that, but 90 is the knob that I know. Let's look at this program again. We had that before. We make a small change because a buffer of size 16 might be too small for the shellcode that we want to write. So we'll make that into 64. Yeah, so I reserve a sufficiently large buffer such that I know that my code, my malicious code, will fit in there. What I'll show now is that a user, an attacker, wants to run who am I on the attack system. Who am I just displays the name of the user. And he wants to use the cat /etc/shadow, which I don't speak Unix, but which apparently shows the content of the password file, which should not be done for any user, right? The root user, he can do that. Any other user should not be able to do that. Here we see, just as a start, we see that there is a file buffer 4 from a user Knopix with root access on that file. Who am I? Will give you the name of the user, Knopix. And then that is not that the privileges of that particular user are not high enough that he can look at this password file. So permission denied when he executes the second command. But now we will use the buffer overflow in that file, in that program buffer 4, because if that program is running, that program is running with root privileges. So if I can run my shell under that particular program, then I have root privileges, and then I can look at the password file. Again, before you can do this, you have to analyze how everything looks. And apparently, to fill the buffer all the way up to the frame pointer, you need 88 bytes, of which 64 are originally for that particular variable, but there are some more. Yeah, so we have 88 bytes. Then the next byte will start overwriting the frame pointer, and then the next one after that will start overwriting the return pointer. So what we do is we had the code. We have that here.
Where?
There, at the bottom. That code, that's not 88 bytes. I'll put just some knobs at the beginning, just to fill it up to 88 bytes. Yeah, so I start with the number of knobs, plus the relevant code, and then that should add up to 88 bytes. The frame pointer we leave untouched. We'll just leave it to what it is. The return address is set such that it is, I don't know exactly where the code will be, but I'll set it to somewhere in that knob sled. Yeah, maybe at the beginning, maybe at the middle, maybe at the end, whatever. Yeah, but if I know that I am pointing to somewhere in this knob sled, then it will start executing knobs at the beginning, and then at some point it will start executing the code that I want to execute. And then, of course, it's a string that I want to input, and so I have to end up with a null character. Or a new line. Yeah, so you see the 90s at the beginning, 90, 90, 90, which is coding for the no operator. And then the exact code is coming. And then here, where is it? BF, I don't see it. Oh, here. Here at the end, you can find the exact value. Here at the end is the return pointer. Yeah, so if I start running that, what happens? Here you see the output. Obviously, what the program is doing is not making sense anyway, so it will print something which doesn't make sense. Your value for name is blah, and that doesn't really make sense. But then the who am I command is run in this shell that I just started. Well, now, because I'm running buffer4, which has root privileges, it assumes that the user is root. So who am I will return root, and then actually the cat command will give me the content of the password file. Yeah? Time is short. I will say a bit about defending in general, and then I will refer to the book for your details. In principle, when I want to defend against a buffer overflow attack, I can do that at two points. Either I can do that at compile time, making sure that my code, the programs that I have, is not vulnerable, sufficiently checking, etc., etc. Or I'll do it at runtime. So I get some program from somebody else, and when I execute it on my machine, I protect. Probably a combination of both is the best. Different ways of doing this. Programming language. C language is, let's say, an intermediate language. You have the high-level languages, and you have the machine code. C is somewhere in the middle that can do some of the tricks with which manipulates the memory, etc. If I use a high-level language, I don't have that possibility anymore, and so that makes it by default more secure. There is internal checking inside such a high-level language. It comes at a cost. Yes, if I need to do checking, that will cost time, but it's more secure. So that's one possibility. Safe coding techniques. Yeah, making sure that the code that I write, even though I'm using insecure functions, if I make sure that I do the checking myself all of the time, if I have the good call to get S instead of just the general call, I can do that. I'll skip. I can do some protection of the stack also. Yeah, making sure that, for example, I can put a random value there and see if that value changes. Should be random, should be not predictable, so that an attacker, when he overrides the buffer, he has to pick a value that should come there, and if that value that I selected when creating the buffer, when creating the stack, has changed, yeah, then I know something is wrong. If I have to protect my system, so runtime protection, yeah, what I could do is make sure that there is no executable code in the stack. So whenever somebody tries to execute code that is on the stack, say, oh, this particular part of the memory is non-executable. Yeah, even though there is code that could be interpreted, or there are bytes that could be interpreted as code, I can't execute them. There are particular problems with that also, because some of these programs have support for executable code on the stack. That would then no longer be possible. So something else needs to be done there. Address space randomization. Yeah, so what the attacker did was run the program on his own machine, see what the program was doing, see where a return address, where it could point such that his code would be executed. Yeah, if I make sure that whenever I execute it, I'll take a random part of the memory, yeah, then obviously the task is extremely much more difficult. Yeah. So there are some ways to defend against buffer overflow attacks. We can't trust that all of the software that we get is created in a good manner. Yeah, so we have to do some protection of our own too. We can't avoid that. One of the things that I mentioned in the beginning was use higher level languages. Higher level languages have the disadvantage that they can't communicate directly with the software. So we need drivers for that. And that driver, again, has to be written in C or in a lower level software. And so I get the same problem anyway. I think I'll leave it for with that for today. Any questions? No questions. Okay, good. And thank you for coming. Okay.